Meeting of the Education Sub of Ways and Means. It is March the 18th. And Mr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, we do have a crowded agenda today, and Heck is waiting with bated breath to start tomorrow, so it would be best if we could finish up ODE first. But the first thing on the agenda is, as you see up on the screens, this is a document we posted yesterday. It's based on the co-chair's budget. Is the Legislative Revenue Office run district by district for both years of the current biennium, and what's projected as the estimates for the second or for next biennium based on the co-chair's budget. Day is here to answer. We wanted to make sure we give the subcommittee any opportunity to question this time, because I'm not sure exactly when we're going to run the state school fund. We have not been told when to, or that we should schedule it yet, but it could be relatively soon. So we wanted to give you the opportunity to ask any questions today from LRO, who is responsible for the upkeep and running these models. So Day is here. If there are no questions, we'll move on to ODE.
Doug, like that.
Or Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Huffman.
So it's on OLIS, and yep. What would it be under yesterday's?
It's under yesterday.
Meeting materials?
Meeting materials. I think it's the bottom one on the meeting materials. I tried the one on 5016 and it didn't load. But it may be, and it will be patient. It takes a little bit to load.
Okay.
It's a big file. So Day's here to answer any questions on, you know, anything that you have. If not, we'll move on to ODE.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I have read it and looked at the document, so I have a reasonable understanding. But I've had conversations early this morning with one of my superintendents, who I want to make sure that I can clearly articulate the difference between this run and the previous run that we had in the governor's budget. So the governor's budget had a run, and I've tried to explain that the basic difference is that instead of using 3% for property tax growth, we're using 5% for property tax growth. Can you tell us what the amount of money that would be added into the school fund in that 2% statewide is? Because they think of it as 7.2, and they think that since you're not changing to 7.2, they're not getting any more money. It may look like it, but it's still 7.2. So what is that additional money that's being put into the system that wasn't there in the original document that we got?
So co-chairs, Senator Roblin, so roughly speaking, about $1.6 billion is property
tax. And we need your name on the record.
I should know that. co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, this is Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. Good morning. So co-chairs and Senator Roblin, so it's about $1.6 billion for schools, school districts, and ESDs. So times 0.02 would make that difference.
So the 0.02 is the amount of that 1.6 that's additional to the original amount. Do you know what the original amount was? I can do the math, but I'm just wanting. Okay, we'll just do the math. So the 0.02 of the 1.6 billion, which is a couple hundred million dollars.
We'll ask
them. So that's the amount of increase that is in the system based on the increase in the percentage of property tax.
Co-chairs, Roblin, I would guess so. Let me explain a little more about our estimate.
Yes.
So we had a peak at 14-15 property tax preliminary data provided by DOR. So what we saw for 14-15 was 5.1% growth for 14-15. Just permanent rate basis, school districts, and ESDs. So We looked at macro data, and of course ODE reflects district's input to ODE, and they compile their own estimates. But our assumption is that for the next 2 years, we're going to have about 5% growth in property taxes and 4.7% the year after. So that's our basic assumption about property taxes. About other components, about 5% of local revenue. There's common school fund. We haven't changed forecast much. Timber sales figures, we haven't changed forecast much. So the basic difference would be property taxes.
Okay.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the growth you're talking about, we've got a 3% cap, but the growth you're talking about is based on new construction coming into the market.
Yes. Residential and industrial and commercial. But at the same time, there is the real estate market has sort of hysteresis, like delayed reaction. So you saw in 2009 when economy tanked, still property tax went up. And we had delayed response in 2010 through 12 and improving 2013. Improved quite a bit in 2014.
Mr. Chair, sorry, David, but for clarification, when you say property tax goes up, it automatically goes up.
By 3%.
Because the ballot measure, but you're talking about property tax revenue increasing.
Yes.
Okay. So not just the 3%, but you're talking about additional revenue because of...
Of new construction and... yes.
Related. Need to get the terms.
Yes.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, if Doug or Day could correct me, but as we heard lots of public testimony from our schools over the past week, over 3 days, that the current projected budget would not be enough. But what we see on these runs are not the we don't see the federal funds that are coming into a school district, and we don't see other funds that come into the school district. So when people look at these, can you explain the things that they need to watch for to show that there are differences?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, the numbers that are included or assumed in this run are just the state school fund budget, the 7.235 million, I hope I got that number right off the top of my head, or billion, excuse me, not million.
Billion, yes.
Plus the local revenues, which are 3.2 billion over the biennium also, roughly. So that just reflects that. These runs do not reflect any of the grant and aid programs, many of which you're hearing about, hopefully hearing about later today with the Mr. Saxton, a law that includes both general fund and other and federal funds. So this is just this what we call the formula revenue that comes out of the state school fund and generally property taxes and local property.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I think that definition needs to be written out and put on a sign by, on the front of the Capitol or something so that people know.
Plastered on my forehead, maybe?
Yeah, foreheads work for me. But because people don't understand why there's such a variation in different school budgets. And the last comment that I would make, because Representative Taylor and I serve on the general government subcommittee, and we're learning about PERS this week, all week, and it became another aha to me that because of the bill that we passed 2 years ago, the school as employers will pay $186 million less to PERS in this next biennium than they did in the past one, so that those will be differences too, depend upon how many employees and all that stuff. But there is just a every time I turn around, there's another variable that impacts the formula.
And Madam Chair, members, keep in mind that this is a run of a revenue run. It does not take into account the individual spending patterns or assumptions or changes or whatever the districts have made. This is the school or the state or the formula of revenue that flows to districts resulting from the state school fund and the property taxes. And the calculation that went into at least the current service level number, which many of these numbers were sort of based on or worked from, did include a substantial decrease in the PERS rates and the assumptions of coming up with the numbers. So
okay,
that's
so
built
that is,
in.
That's built
already
in.
In.
Okay.
So
that's helpful. Thank you.
And Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to give too much credit or too little credit to OSBA and COSA, but I got to think that when they're coming up with the 7.875 billion, that they have also considered increase in property tax and stuff. They've, again, I don't want to give too much or too little credit, but I can't believe that they don't have access to the same numbers, and they're only looking at, when they look at their total need, that they're only looking at the 7.235 billion. I mean, it sounds like we're kind of thinking that maybe school districts weren't counting all the potential revenue or impacts of the PERS, assuming the Supreme Court does what we'd like to hear. But
I'm as we all are, waiting with bated breath for that court decision, because some of us still have our blood on the floor from that tough vote a couple of years ago. Additional, Senator Roblin, anything?
The only thing I would say, I tend to agree that they will look at those things, but they have to use the assumptions that we give them to use.
Yes.
And I think they have been using the assumption of 3% growth, and this will be the first time when this is out public that we've actually looked at a run that has a different assumption. And I don't know that it'll make an enormous amount of difference. As I looked at this, it made a difference in the number of school districts which were going to get less money per weighted average than was in the original, in the other run. So I doubt that they can use a different number if it's not out there. So they may look at it, they may assume that there could be a little bit more. And I'm not sure that that's a significant amount of money that makes a big difference, but it might change a little bit.
And they
can only use the numbers that they're given. They can't make that up, so.
But using those different assumptions, 3% versus 5%, for example, enables them or allows them to say they would get less money next year than they're getting this year, when if you use the 5% assumption, they're getting a little bit more.
Not significantly, but yes.
It's generally in the realm of under $100 per kid.
Yeah.
Additional...
Mr. Chair, just to point out a couple other differences, because I think what there have been two sets of numbers out there, and I'm sorry, Rob. there was numbers or run released by or posted by the department based on the co-chair's number that used the general 3%. The other difference between this run and that run include the co-chairs are now thinking or now assuming that they will put in the state school fund a 50-50 match or a 50-50 split instead of the 49-51. And it has gone back and forth over the years which to use. And this run also spreads some numbers across districts that the others don't. Generally, the school or the department holds back $20 million a year initially from the distribution to make sure they have enough money as ADMs change over the biennium and other factors. That is, in the end, distributed to school districts at the end of the year or during the closeout period. And these numbers spread that, and that other set of numbers that the department posted did not spread that, is my understanding. And I think the other thing is that this also includes the high cost disabilities number spread across districts, and theirs don't also spread that. So those are all numbers that end up in the district's hands.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Anything else? Dave, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming down this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Mr. Saxon.
Mr. Chair,
Madam Co-Chair.
I think we have about 60 slides, so that's 1 minute per slide, Mr. Saxton. So,
Co-Chair's compliment row. Members of the committee, for the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Talking faster already.
69 slides, 10 questions to answer from the previous day. So I'm going to hit the questions to answer from the previous day with your permission. So, and I think I can hit most of them fairly quickly. The first was provide facility grant amount recently received by North Wasco School District 21 in the Dalles. So they spent $840,000 and change on new facility square footage. They were reimbursed $67,246, roughly 8% of the claim amount, which is what's intended in law. You can see several pages into the documents that we provided you. I think it's the third page back. See if that's correct. Yes. All school districts by project, what they spent on the project, and then what they were reimbursed as their part from the new facilities grant. So we have that detailed for you on all of those. Really actually interesting to look at that. I spent a little bit of time looking at it just because I found a fair amount of interest in that. Number two, in phase two of the agency's presentation, will the subcommittee receive reports on the outcome of the network? That. Yes, you will. And in fact, we have from page 47 forward on the network included here that if you'd like to take a look at it, it gives you some outcomes on all the investments. And then we also created a report that I was going to hold up later today that looks like this. It's a beast. And this is from all the strategic investments from the previous session, but from page 47 forward, specifically around those more associated with teaching and learning.
Thank you.
And actually, I've read that report several times in editing and so on, and so there's some interesting data in there, and be happy to go through some parts of that with you. Number three, how many students are at the Oregon School for the Deaf? What's the total amount per student? I was correct at 117. I didn't have the amount per student. It's $67,000 per student per year. About two-thirds of the students, and I'll have this data for you later today, are resident students, so they stay overnight there, right there in a dormitory. And so number four, is there a maintenance of effort amount for early intervention? And I wasn't sure. Yes, there is, and it's all part of the total that we get in IDEA. So those are all totals, and the maintenance effort comes along with that. I'll talk about maintenance of effort more today. How does growth in EI, ECSE compare with growth in the population? Interesting chart, took me a little while to understand it. I would direct your eyes to the lower right-hand corner, lower right-hand number, which shows a 0.36%. That is the increased growth in EI over the increase in total population. And so, yes, from 2010 to 2013, there is some increase in EIECSE. I wouldn't say it's really a bunch. I do anticipate that there'll be more as we invigorate the early learning across the state and the hubs become increasingly effective. Number seven, please provide a list of contractors for both EIECSE and regional programs. The last five pages of your document have a couple of maps that show both the regional contractors and then also the contact information for the contractors. I actually was surprised at the amount of overlap that exists in each of the eight regions for both EI and then for regional programs. The place where I really see a difference is in Clackamas County. There seems to be a difference, and then other regions of the state are almost identical and completely overlap, and the list of contractors is included. So if you take a look at that map, you'll see the differences in the Clackamas area, and not just Clackamas, but within that vicinity. Number seven was, do we still do 10th grade testing? And the answer is yes, we do. And also, is there a collection that ODE does? Not really. We don't really collect a lot of information about that. I know that the College Board collects a fair amount of information. We spent about just over $2 million a year on that program. We had an interesting conversation about that at the department yesterday, prompted by your question, which was the Oaks assessment didn't really have a college and career readiness alignment. It didn't. It was aligned to Oregon's old standards. And if I showed you some of the old Oregon's old standards graph, it would turn your hair my color because our standards were incredibly low. In fact, in the third grade, our standards were at the 16th percentile. We told kids if they could read at the third grade benchmark in Oregon that they were on track to be successful, and they were reading at the 16th percentile on a nationally normed reference test. And the graphs on that are very interesting, and I'll probably show those later this week in some testimony. But at any rate, no, we did not. Now, the new assessment, Smarter Balanced, actually has a score that aligns very precisely to expected college success. And so one of my questions is, I mean, part of what we were trying to do with that is determine whether or not students were on track to be college ready mm-hmm. with the 10th grade assessment. Now we have a test that does that, Smarter Balanced. It's an expensive assessment. We spend $2 million on the 10th grade test and then a lot more than that on Smarter Balanced, right? And my question simply is, do we need to continue to do that or not?
Representative,
I think it's an interesting
thank
discussion.
You, Mr. Chair. So, Rob, do you think maybe by 17 you'll be able to come back with a recommendation as to whether we need to do both or?
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Representative Huffman, I think prudence would probably have us come back in 17 and make a recommendation about that. Because we continue to talk about $60 million and what's available in the state budget, sometimes I would like to make that recommendation earlier, but it would probably be prudent to do that in 17. Number eight, is the Oregon School Virtual School District available to homeschoolers and the answer, or private school? And the answer to that is no, it is not. My experience, however, on that would be that there are many homeschool students who do avail themselves to OVSD, but through their local public school district. And so in my old district, we had an online component where lots of students who would, and parents who would consider themselves homeschoolers, I mean, kind of the air quote homeschooler, would also come to this storefront that we had leased, where we had technology and some support and access educational materials through OVSD. We then claimed them as a student if they attended at least part-time, but most of their schooling experience was through homeschool. So there's a lot of that kind of combination instruction that takes place, but technically, if you're just homeschool or just private school, no, OVSD is not available. There were two other questions. I'll call it number nine. Is the Oregon Virtual School District, oh, I already answered that. Does Oregon Virtual School District collect information on students, and how does ODE keep individual student data secure? No, we do not collect information on students. The system is housed at the Oregon State University web systems where it's hosted, and the systems are guarded by protections, firewalls, antivirus, and the like. And so we do not collect personal information, however. And then last, on a percentage basis, is the growth in the transportation grant greater than the growth in the state school fund? There's a fairly sizable chart on that, and there has been some growth in general over time. If I go back to 92-93, it was about 2.89, and it stayed in the threes, about 3% of the total, until 2004, where it jumped into the really high threes, 3.94, and then went to just over 4%, the highest being 3.1 in 2010. And but in 13-14, it was back to 3.96. I think there is evidence here that it is a stabilizing force, and that when budgets go down, the percentage of, that's spent on transportation goes up because there's less money in total, but the amount that's spent on transportation remains fairly constant. And when budgets go up, like in 13-14, the percent that's spent on transportation goes down because there's more money overall, but we're at 3.96. So it moved from about 3% early to about 4% now. Okay. Slide 209, hospital programs. All right. We have roughly 140 students that are served in each year in three private hospitals, the state mental hospital, and then there's six individual children's units within those three private hospitals. Nearly three-quarters of the students have disabilities. They also have other kinds of complicating factors like acute long-term medical needs due to cancer, severe burns, head injuries, or other chronic diseases requiring frequent hospitalization. About 72% of those served are students with disabilities. So sometimes the disability is inherent in what I just described, like if there's traumatic brain injury and so forth, and then other times not. It might be a student who has severe burns, for example, or cancer, but there's no kind of cognitive or disability impairment. We contract with ESDs and local hospitals to provide instruction while students are hospitalized. Long-term care and treatment. So there are about 2,000 students annually that are served by long-term care and treatment programs. Typically, these students have a designation of emotionally disturbed and some kind of a psychosis that goes along with the designation. The Christie School, Farm Home, and some other facilities would be representative of that. The Department of Human Services and the Oregon Youth Authority place these students into residential or day treatment programs, providing a protected educational environment for students and allowing for the extension of the treatment process into the school day. We contract with 26 districts or ESDs to administer the programs, and the average length of stay in the program is 140 days. Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund. In 2009, House Bill 2834 closed the Oregon School for the Blind and established the Blind and Visually Impaired Student Fund. The fund originally served 28 students, of which six currently remain in school. The funds were intended for use to assist with the education and services to blind and visually impaired students and to supplement the funds available to regional programs to ensure access to expanded core curricula for these students. The services are provided by a regional contractor with ODE staff providing the oversight. Oregon School for the Deaf. This year, as I said earlier, OSD provides schooling for 117 students from kindergarten to age 21. 70 of those students are residential students that spend the week overnight in dorms, and 47 are day students. The school's mission is to provide a comprehensive program designed to meet unique needs of deaf and hard of hearing students through a dual language, American Sign Language English model of instruction, assuring academic achievement that leads to a full range of post-secondary opportunities. And we're not yet where we want to be at the Oregon School for the Deaf, but I think that we're making really great progress. I can see it in the school and the way the school looks, the way I see things taking place at the school, and their really strong commitment to improving instructional practices within the classroom. I've been really pleased at the times that I've gone and visited the school to see the focus on that improved instruction and the dedication of staff to There are two things I really want you to hear me say about the school, which I think has changed somewhat over the past 2 years, and I wasn't really sure of 2 years ago when I presented to this committee, but I am very confident about this as I sit in front of you today, and that is that I believe that the students who attend the school learn more and have better outcomes than they would if they attended their home school. And that's a really important question that this committee has asked me, and I believe that to be true. And the second is that these students receive multiple benefits through their attendance that really can't get anyplace else in the state of Oregon. And there are a couple important concepts that we talk about in special education. One of those is inclusion. And inclusion means that a student with a disability is included in all things typical at the school. And that happens at OSD in its totality. I mean, there is no, the students at the school and at that school, they are typical with typical peers and doing everything that would happen at a school within the least restrictive environment. And the other is a least restrictive environment, and so the environment provides the most normalcy where the student can access learning, and the Oregon School for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing students get both. And in fact, for these students, it's the only place where they can have typical interactions with their school-age peers and learn to arbitrate their own socialization. So the point is that when our deaf and hard of hearing students attend school at a regular school, there's always an adult translator who manages their communication through translation and makes it virtually impossible for them to have typical interaction or socialization with their peers. There's always this adult that translates every interaction for them. So if a child wants to speak to a non hearing impaired student, there's never a normal interaction there. They speak, the translation occurs, the other student speaks, the translation occurs, and it comes back to the student. And so all of their interaction is arbitrated by an adult. There's no typical peer-to-peer interaction. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, that's just not the case. Those students interact with one another on a regular basis on a typical peer-to-peer communication paradigm, and they learn to navigate the world like kids learn to navigate the world between one another. And that's a really unique setting.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Rob, do you have information on how School of the Deaf stacks up for graduation rates, and then what percentage of students move on to higher ed?
Co-chairs Compton, Rural Representative Huffman, yes, and I'll get into that here in just a second.
Okay,
if you
good.
if
that's great, thanks.
If it pleases the committee, I would tell you that the not as well as would a typical public school, and I think there's some rationale for that, and I'll talk about that a little bit as well. So it's been really a joy for me over the last couple of years to watch the improved high-quality instruction in the classroom and to observe students engaged across campus in the social interaction, attend athletic contests, graduation ceremonies, and so forth, and to see how the students move about the school and the kind of instruction and support that they get. This map shows the shaded counties where students have come from across Oregon to attend the school over the past 8 years. And the counties with the dots are where students are currently attending the school from. You can see that there are some counties that don't have dots or that have not had students attend in the last 8 years, but typically they are areas that don't have as many students. Not completely true on the map, but largely true. 17, this talks about the demographics of the students at the Oregon School for the Deaf. 17 Oregon School for the Deaf students are in the adult transition services, meaning that they're from age 18 to 21 years of age. 59 students, making up roughly 50% of the total, are high school age, and 25 are middle schoolers, and 16 are elementary school age. Typically, the majority of the residential students are older, either middle school or high school, and very few elementary age students attend and are in the overnight component of the school. What this slide doesn't say, but I think is an important takeaway from the concept, is that students often arrive at the school only after having been less successful in their home district. When I say less successful, it would be that more likely they've failed or that they're way behind in their current school district, and so they haven't really had an opportunity to access learning. I think if we all think about this from our own parent perspective, to think that I would send my child to a residential school, I would at first try everything that I could to have them be successful in their home school, and I would probably only take that action where I sent them to a school where they're gonna be there all week long if I felt like they weren't getting what they need or that we're not having success at our local school. And so oftentimes, it's taking out to sort of the nth degree where this is last hope, last opportunity. And then students are sent there, and so oftentimes are way behind where they would have been maybe if they'd been at the school longer. And we see really rapid gains early as students learn. Some students show up fairly late in their schooling, not really having any sign language skill and that kind of thing, or having had much opportunity to interact with others who have it. And so oftentimes there's a fair amount of learning delay. They do learn quickly, and many parents covered that stuff. Primary disability category. So when students are identified as having a learning disability, they're given a primary disability category. And it's the category that identifies their most prevalent learning challenge. And so sometimes in the past when I've shown this, people have said, well, why would there be some students who are at this school whose primary disability is intellectual disability? And it simply is that is the more profound diagnosis, basically. It's the overriding diagnosis. The student still is hearing impaired, but they also have an intellectual disability, and it is the primary disability that is on the IEP.
Mr. Saxon, most of the major high schools nowadays or school districts have alternative high schools. that are for students that haven't made it in the regular high school, and it's kind of a last resort. I know David Douglas has Fir Ridge, and most districts have such a program. Are you comparing the School for the Deaf to one of those kinds of programs?
Co-Chair Monroe, very nice question. I don't know that I'd really compare it to that exactly, because the instructional practice at an alternative school often looks really different than the typical school where students have not had success. And the instruction and the program that I see at the Oregon School for the Deaf looks a lot more like a typical elementary, middle, or high kind of instructional program and so on, except that everything is in American Sign Language. All the communication is in American Sign Language. And so that really is the differentiator. I would say that most of the time when students move to alternative schools, not always, but often, is because they've not had success in their home school. And I would say very much the Oregon School for the Deaf is like that, in that kind of a decision on the part of parents and students to move to the school.
Because there are thousands of deaf students in Oregon that are not going to the School for the Deaf, that are going to their regular elementary or high school, and many of them are having significant success.
Co-Chair Monroe, that's absolutely true. And I think it varies a little bit based on district and program, whether or not they're having success in their home school and perhaps the setting. And I think there are a lot of other components that come along with that around what happens with the use and practice of American Sign Language in all components of the student's life.
Okay.
So 94% of the students at the Oregon School for the Deaf have deaf or hard of hearing as their primary category, but then the next biggest, I think, is autism spectrum with just under 4%. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, they have direct instructions by certified teachers of the deaf, not moderated by an interpreter, and they provide transition counselors who understand the effects of deafness on school, on students and families and school, and they offer a complete transition package with outside agencies who are knowledgeable about deaf issues. And in fact, they have a vocational rehabilitation center located right on campus who work with older students to help them transition to school and or into the world of work with good success. It's a really excellent program. And if we ever decide to take a tour, I know we did that last session, it would be great to show you some of the instruction and also the VR site that's on the campus where you can see the work that's done with the students. It's really strong. Like other schools, Oregon School for the Deaf teaches to our adopted state standards, including the Common Core. Educators are evaluated using the same statewide evaluation system outlined in Senate Bill 290 and through our federal waiver agreement with the U.S. Department of Education. They have increased their emphasis on literacy with a lab designed to help students who are struggling to read, and they've reestablished a strong CTE program with technology, film production, and what used to be called industrial arts programs like metals and woods. And they're redefining the implementation of their extensive evaluation program. And the reestablishment of the CTE program has been quite amazing, and I've watched that as they've gone in and reestablished the facilities themselves and done some of the work that it takes to be able to offer those programs. OSE is able to offer additional support of 1.5 hours after school, which is unusual and a little bit interesting, and they are able to offer that for all students, and part of that is the residential component of this. When a student goes home, typically a parent or somebody gives them some support, I hope, around getting some homework done for at least an hour and a half, and I think that the idea here is that the school is going to do the same. They also have other after-school activities like bicycle repair, weightlifting, and then organized OSAA-sponsored sports, volleyball, football, track, and basketball, and so forth. Very typical kind of school activities. Because, and this is a little bit on some of the results Representative Huffman talked about, and there probably are a couple questions we could get on this around college going that I can get back to you with, but because many OSD students arrive at the school significantly behind their typical peers, it's important to have majors which can determine student learning and growth. And lots of school districts use different kinds of assessments to get at this. The Oregon School for the Deaf had not, but is now offering a program that is an assessment setup that's developed by the Northwest Evaluation Association, or NWEA, as it's commonly known, which can help them measure beginning of year over year learning growth, and even beginning to end of year growth, because it's an interim assessment package where they can look at student growth over time and make sure that the program that they're offering is helping the student move as quickly as possible, and is particularly important as students arrive at the school. Here you'll see a representation of year-over-year growth on language usage for the Oregon School for the Deaf, with achievement gains at each level, elementary, middle, and high. And just a couple other slides on that. This one is around mathematics. The red is average student results in the spring of 13, and blue is average results for the same cohort in the spring of 14. So it is the growth measure from red to blue. And then lastly, the same kind of idea, but with reading achievement between the spring of 13 and 14. And that's on a cohort of students, and so this is a group of students in one testing session, and then a year later the same group of students in another testing session, so that we're measuring the growth of those individual students. And you can do this on an individual by individual, and what I'm showing you here is the school collective. This graph represents the percentage of students meeting the Oaks benchmark in grades 3 through 8 and 11, and you can see that this is very low. In fact, there was a dip between 11-12 and 12-13, and then we've seen some growth in 13-14, and I believe that you're going to see that trend line continue to increase over time. But at the Oregon School for the Deaf currently, there are 3 students out of 39 students who took the assessment in, doesn't say the year, but I think that this is last spring. So these are the 2014 results, who passed the benchmark on Oaks in reading. This is the same kind of graph, but this has to do with mathematics. This shows 2 students, and you see the same dip in the 12-13 school year where none did, and now there are a couple students that do. And I do believe, again, we'll see a continued upward trend on this, and it is a focus at the school. And I see instruction that would bring that into line. When we look at graduation and completers, one of the changes that we made this year, and there's a couple different ways we could have shown you this graph, but I felt like with this sort of a no smokescreen approach is a good idea. And so I could show you the percentage of students, how much the percentage of students graduating the 4-year cohort has gone up, because it has a bunch. But most of the reason for that would have been because we changed the modified diploma to count in the 4-year cohort. And you can see that 45% of the students last year, almost 46%, received a modified diploma. It counts as the 4-year cohort, and here's a couple really important considerations that come along with this, and why it was so important for us to do this modified diploma change. We had students who were graduating from the Oregon School for the Deaf and getting scholarships at Gallaudet University, which is back, I think, in Washington, D.C., for hearing impaired students, who could not get who were being offered scholarships through the federal government, who could not qualify because they had a modified diploma in Oregon, and they had nowhere to go if they wanted to continue on with schooling. But this school was accepting them, and now those students are able to go with scholarships, and it's a really profound difference. And so 50% of the students graduated either with a diploma or modified diploma. If you look back over time at the school, it's in that same ballpark. But you'll also see that in 2012-13, there were 11 students who graduated or exited the school in one form or another, and in 13-14, it was 24. So nearly twice as many students exited the school in 13-14, and 50% with a diploma or modified diploma. I do not have the part about college going. Representative Huffman will make sure and get that for you. You can see on slide 225 that over the past 2 years, we've completed a number of maintenance projects at the school, and we use resources from a variety of sources, including proceeds from the Oregon School for the Blind. So that was, I think, a 50-50 split, and some of those dollars went here. Revenue from leased property at the school. So the school is a fairly large facility with large grounds. and used to house more students than it does currently, although it's starting to grow slightly over the last couple of years. And so we have a couple charter schools that lease space in the school and a couple other places and some other lease opportunities, and we're using those proceeds around the maintenance of the school. We also are looking for revenue from other leased property. There's a lot of fundraising that takes place at the school, including the Nightmare Factory, which brings in significant funds every year. It's a haunted house at the school, and it's a great activity, and I don't remember the amount, but it's, you know, approximates $100,000 in revenue from that event every year. We currently have 12 acres of the property which have gone largely unused that are up for sale or up for lease. Mm-hmm. We've had negotiations on it a couple of times, but we haven't quite been able to get there. We've replaced the roof, gutters, and seismic upgrades have been key to preserving the assets that currently exist. When you have water intrusion, you're just going to have all kinds of bad trouble down the road. And so we had a little of that going on. We've been able to stop that with the upgrades on the roofs and feel like the school's in good shape and continues to get in better shape. This summer, we're going to finally have the HVAC heating, ventilation, and air conditioning upgrade. And that will be moving into place and should be in place by next fall, which will be account for some cost savings in associated with energy use, but also in cost savings around people who needed to be working on the boiler all the time. The 13-15 OSD budget was $15.6 million all funds, $11.4 million, and 74% of that was from the general fund, and there are 75 FTE at the school. This is basically the same slide, but it's a current service level budget. Again, roughly 75 FTE. Percent of the expenditures at the school for 15-17 CSL are personnel, and represent $13.3 million. That is consistent with my experience. I always sort of say school districts typically are about 85% of the cost is associated with personnel, and so 84% is right in line with that. And that ends my presentation on OSD. Be happy to come back at a later date if there's some additional information that the committee would like to see on that in one of the future days.
Have you made any changes to leadership out there in the last 2 years?
Senator Monroe, yes. We have a new director at the school who's in charge of the school. I know she's here today. Charlotte,
there she is.
Back there, and okay. She's doing a wonderful job.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, 229. Each year, school districts receive federal allocations under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, IDEA, and provide special education-related services to eligible students. Districts must find, evaluate, identify, and develop individual plans for these students. One of the more interesting parts of that for me is the find part. So districts have a duty to do child find and identify students who would be eligible for additional support. Districts and the state must meet maintenance of effort, MOE, requirements. MOE means spend at least as much year over year on providing special education support. It's a really interesting concept, right? You have to spend at least the same amount any 1 year over the next on special education in order to meet federal requirements. That amount cannot go down. Typically, you know, $1 more is a good move. If ODE or local districts don't meet maintenance of effort, then they're required to repay the amount by which they fall short in maintenance of effort using non-federal funds. So you can't pay the federal government back with federal money. You have to use other funds to do that. Our performance with IDEA is reviewed annually by the U.S. Department of Education, and a little bit of information about that, including the report cards that come along with it, and some websites I know that you all are going to need to, in order to cure insomnia. On 3/31 in the 10/11 school year, the state didn't meet maintenance of effort by $13.8 million, and there were some confounding parts of that, but budget reductions were a good component of it. And we had to ask the legislature to appropriate that amount to satisfy the federal requirement. And so you did appropriate $13.8 million, and it was spent on special education, so we didn't need to pay it back. And instead, we had additional. it was uncomfortable, but I know that that happened. This is just a list of the programs whose expenses are calculated into maintenance of effort. So hopefully on here you'll see EI, ECSE, and if I had, you know, owned this better, I wouldn't have had to answer that question under separate cover today. But Special Education Department Operations, School for the Deaf, and a lot of the things that I just covered, right? Blind, visually impaired, hospital, regional programs, high-cost disability, and so forth. I won't go through all of those, but those all are totaled up to go into maintenance of effort. From special ed to compensatory grant programs serving students, Oregon receives compensatory grants in education. We commonly refer to them as title grants. So when you hear people say Title I, Title II, Title VI, that's what educators typically mean. Budget people like to call them compensatory grants, and people get confused between the two. They're one and the same. We call them title grants in school districts because it is an entitlement. If you apply for it, you get it. It's not a competitive grant. Some of the things that are included, Title 1A, 1C, which is migrant education. 1A is grants to local education agencies for students in poverty. Title 2A, which is teacher quality, and that has to do with staff development for educators. Title 3, around ELL, English language learners. Title 4B is the 21st Century Community Learning Centers, and then Carl Perkins Career and Technical Education. We receive also about $354 million from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for reimbursements on nutrition programs. Title 1A is the largest of the ESEA programs at roughly $300 million per biennia, 99% of which go out in compensatory title grants, and the funds are distributed on a poverty formula based on census data. These funds go to supporting children from low-income families or who are at risk of failing academic standards. They're for supplemental services such as intervention programs or extended time. Over the last few days, there have been some questions about assessment practices in the state. And one of those being what states need to do in order to meet their ESEA waiver requirements. So both the way, there's two different parts here. One is what we do to the waiver, around the waiver, and what we've promised with the federal government we're going to do according to the waiver. And then that would be what I would call No Child Left Behind waiver. And then there's ESEA Central, Education Secondary Education Act Central, not the waiver. One of the things the federal government requires is that we test all students, grades 3 through 8, and in grade 11, at least once a year using a summative assessment. This year, Smarter Balanced. We've talked about, and if you'll look at the recommendations that we've made even, that we would like to do sample testing. And we'd like to get to that at some point in time down the road. But the federal government is not allowing for sample testing at this point in time. And were we to sample test, we would need to give back all of the funds that are listed under Title 1A. It's about somewhere between $500 and $700 million. So $300 million in Title 1 alone. And so the sample testing, while it's a good idea and something we'd like to get to, and I think over time, if we can technically demonstrate that we're able to do it in a way that gives us back good data about growth in school districts, and I think we can get there. But there's one state in the union that's gotten permission to do that. It took them 5 years of effort to develop the testing package, and only four school districts are participating in that this year, and I think it's New Hampshire. And only four districts participated because the amount of work that teachers had to do to scale that up was very onerous. And so I know that we don't want to give back all of our funds. We would be the only state in the nation that would actually do that. No state has ever tempted the U.S. government, and when we've talked to the U.S. Department of Ed and asked them, would you allow that, they've said, not no, but heck no, and if you do, know that you will lose your $500, $700 million in federal funds. This will not be a debate. So that's where we sit on that currently. I just add that tidbit because I would hate to lose those funds, and so would everybody else. Slide 236. Some of our Title I funds are now used to support the lowest 15% of Title I schools in the state, and they're typically elementary schools with the lowest 5% being called priority schools, and the next lowest 10% deemed focus schools. We're currently serving 41,000 students in 91 schools with this model. And when I say 91, that's all schools, high school, middle, and elementary, although there are no middle schools in focus and priority designation currently. Our goal is to move these schools from a school rating of level 1 or 2, which is the lowest rating, that's the lowest 5% and the next lowest 10%, to a higher level, to level 3, basically. The focus and priority process identified these schools in 2012, and once identified, the school is to remain in this status for 4 years. And the reason that we did this, is a little bit unique to the state of Oregon. We identified and said, we're now going to give you 4 years of support regardless of what happens, whether you're a level 1 or a level 5. We're going to give you 4 years of support because typically to embed high leverage practices takes some time. To do it and have it become habit takes about 4 years. And so we've entered into this 4-year process, and it seems like it's one that's working very well compared to what we've seen in other states and with the results that we're beginning to see. The first year is self-evaluation, so they do a self-evaluation. Then there's an external team that comes in and does an evaluation, and then there's an internal and external planning process within that year. And most schools began to implement some of their planning immediately in that first year. And then there's a continuous improvement plan that's developed. We provide coaching for the leadership of the school each year, so each principal has a coach, and the schools receive some additional funds, which is approximately $60,000, and then out of the general fund, the legislature passed an additional source of about $40,000 per school at the elementary level that were targeted specifically around reading efforts for extended time, more time for students after school in the summer to get some extra help. And it could be used on some other reading things too, and I'll get to that in a little bit. We review progress of each school quarterly through a routine of data collection and self-assessment methodology. So we go to each school quarterly, we do a routine with them about how it's coming along, we give them some feedback and help them continue to try to work on their continual improvement process. The goals that we set out in our strategic plan was that by last June, 50% of our focus and priority schools would have exited that status. In other words, they would no longer be a level 1 or 2 rated school, but there'd be a 3, 4, or 5 rated school. We surpassed that, and our goal this year is to have 75% of our schools exited that status, and we believe that we'll actually achieve that, and we'll know as soon as we have assessment results back this summer. We cannot allow students to have their zip code and the boundary of their school determine whether or not they're going to be attending a school that is likely to give them the kind of instruction and support that they need to be successful. And so where we have schools that are chronically underperforming, we need to come alongside and help those schools perform so that the students who attend them have an equal opportunity to all other students. Certainly if we continue to live and work in our school attendance boundary, that might work, but we have a much more competitive situation now where it's actually global and not just the state of Oregon. You can see where we are on this chart and what's happened over the last 3 years. We had 83 schools that were a level 1 or 2, and now only 39 are. That was as of last June. And we believe that many of these schools, those 39 schools, are exiting that status even as we speak through the assessment process that they're engaged in. 51 schools are now either a level 3 or 4, and we expect to increase that number this year. Again, having set a target that 75% of our schools will have exited. That means only 22 schools would remain in level 1 or 2, so we need to see 17 more schools exit level 1 or 2 status this spring, and again, we're pretty confident, given our quarterly reviews, that we're going to see that kind of result. For some schools, the issue doesn't seem to be at the school level. It's kind of interesting, right? We go and we work with this school and we do quarterly reviews and we see things, and we need to acknowledge that a broader system may need support at the district level. And so it isn't just the school, but it seems like it's the whole district oftentimes. And toward that end, we've convened a task force to help us figure out what to do about that. So we brought a bunch of educators together over the past year to figure this out, and they put together a mechanism to identify the 10 lowest performing school districts and implement a system of support to help them improve. We don't think that we can actually help 10. It would be a little bit too expensive, nor that necessarily that we should initially. But what we have designed is a system to help up to 50 schools within districts, and it would be a whole district, so it depends on how many districts we would help, how many the 50 schools would fill up. But we're seeking $3 million through one of the strategic initiatives to do that work in this budget, and then another $2.4 million, so it's a package of $5.4 million total, that would do the work to develop the support of leaders who would have the expertise to do that. And what we find, in fact, I had this phone call from a district superintendent yesterday who said, I need a turnaround leader for this school. I need a principal at this school who's demonstrated the ability to come in and do this kind of thing. I have this person in my sights. Can you help me, like, recruit them? Interesting conversation. They told me the person. I went, yeah, that person will, I mean, get it done hands down and do it in a way that the community will embrace. And this is a really difficult school to move, maybe the most difficult in the state. I believe this person could do it. How do we get more people like that? Right, and so we're working with Chalkboard to develop a system, and this is the $2.4 million ask, to create a cadre of turnaround leaders in the state of Oregon. And we know the kind of training and expertise that it takes to do that, and that's part of the ask that goes along with that. I'm moving on to Migrant Title I-C, which is migrant education. It's a federally funded program that serves 19,000 migrant students and is intended to reduce the education disruption that comes from frequent moves. It's delivered through 19 programs run by districts or ESDs in the state, and we estimate $21 million available in the upcoming biennium. Results data are reported on students entering kindergarten ready to learn and reading at math benchmarks 1 through 12 and high school graduation rates.
Do those students have to be documented?
Co-Chair Monroe, no, they do not.
Thank you.
Title III, English language learners and immigrant youth. Title III is the federal level ELL program. Its purpose is to help ELL students meet the state's academic standards at the same rate and level as all other students. The state receives about $15 million for this purpose per biennia, and the money is distributed to districts on a formula basis. Outcomes are measured on students obtaining English proficiency and reading benchmark in English and math. 130 of our 197 districts serve ELL students. So there are then 67 districts that have zero ELL students in the state. Kind of an interesting number. There are 58,000 roughly ELL students in the state. Title IV-B is the 21st Century Community Learning Centers, and we receive $22 million per biennia from the federal government to pay for this program, and it supports community learning centers intended to offer academic enrichment during non-school hours for children who attend high-poverty, low-performing schools. The program serves just over 20,000 students across the state. CTE. CTE stands for Career and Technical Education, and CTE programs provide high school and community college students with industry-aligned skills and knowledge and hands-on relevant context, in a hands-on relevant context. Students involved in these programs have experiences that allow them to begin imagining themselves in a variety of career situations and thinking about what they can become by age 25. It's one of those programs that actually pull students through high school. There are also students across the state who receive invaluable learning about a variety of skills that are important as they move through life. I think about, oftentimes personalized things. My own child, as I was trying to wire an attic space, saying, I know how to do that, right? Because he'd been in some classes and he knew how to do that. And so he could. And I think that there are lots of kinds of life experiences that students who end up not doing CTE kinds of things do, but there are many students who are involved in CTE programs who then find something that they absolutely love and find a skill set that allows them to think about what they would become. Our budget accounts for $31 million the state should receive in federal Title I CTE basic grants. And a state match of $1.3 million is required to get those funds. That's a pretty good return, which are distributed on a federal formula basis. There are also $9.9 million from the general fund in CTE revitalization grants and $240,000 general fund dollars in student leadership programs like FFA, which is Future Farmers of America, DECA, Distributive Education Clubs, FBLA, Future Business Leaders of America, and the like. I'll stop because if I don't cover them all, I'll just get in trouble. So a lot of support and emotion over those programs because they do really neat things for kids. Yes, I actually have that, I think, on my next slide. Over 170,000 students are served by CTE each year.
Thank you for asking.
The governor's budget proposes an increase of $14.7 million in the 15-17 proposed budget for a total of $24 million in CTE program. And that is not one of the strategic initiatives that's outside of the strategic initiatives. I know we're going to spend some more time talking about that, maybe as early as today, but more likely probably tomorrow. 13-15 CTE revitalization grant. In the economic downturn and with tight budget cuts over the past few years, many districts cut some of their more expensive programs. If a program costs more for a student to be involved in and a district is going to make decisions around budget cuts, oftentimes they cut the most expensive programs, including CTE, and lots of CTE programs were cut over the recession. And then in the last biennial, we offered funds to revitalize CTE grants, to revitalize CTE. And I think even the biennial before that, there was a small investment, but we increased the investment in the last biennial. And it was really through a process of using representatives of schools and industry where we bring people together and review. It was a competitive grant process. We awarded $11.1 million for 32 projects involving 60 high schools across the state and some participation of middle schools and so forth, so 94 schools overall. There were 338 business, industry, and labor partners that were a part of the consortia that were awarded grants. Really incredible programs that have begun to come to scale over the state. And you'll see that most of the money, 53% of it, went for upgrades, and a smaller amount, 23%, went for salaries. So you can see that of those that were awarded and districts and partnerships that received the money, they really needed places and material, you know, things, welding machines and CNC, which is computer-aided cutting machines, basically. And
CAD.
So, yeah, CAD types machines in order to be able to make these into viable industry standard kinds of programs. The outcomes for CTE are really impressive and appear to do a great job of closing achievement gaps. And in fact, nearly 85.7% graduation rate for children who are involved or students who are involved in CTE programs compared to 68.7% for all students. That's a pretty remarkable statistic. When I look at that, I actually challenge our CTE people all the time and say, come on, that cannot be the case. And then, you know, they run me through the data and I acquiesce. Nearly 86% for African-American students compared to 57% for African-American students who are not involved in CTE programs. 82% for Native American, 52% for Native American not involved in CTE. It prepares students for further education and the workforce and the needs of the 21st century, as well as engaging students in a way that can help them stay in school. Pretty impressive. There's some other data around this, like the Foundation for Educational Choice and the Cascade Policy Institute did some work that dropouts cost Oregon approximately $440 million per year by reducing Oregon's tax revenue by $173 million per year and having higher Medicaid costs of nearly $219 million per year and having a higher rate of incarceration costing $48.9 million a year as estimated in 2008. So the costs of not having students graduate from high school to the state are crazy. The investment in these kinds of programs is really low by comparison.
Rob, did you have any, there are a lot of private public partnerships in this. Did you have a figure about how many industry people help contribute to all that success?
Co-Chair Comp, I do not have that specifically. I know that there were 33 partners that came together on the 32 projects that we awarded, and a number of those quite impressive. There were a couple places that initially we did not fund, and then there was a little bit more resource that came, and we were able to fund a couple of them. I looked at a couple of the programs that we did not fund and actually received calls from superintendents who said, I mean, we don't even know what we would have to do. If you look at the list of industry partners and what they're contributing to this program in order to offer things to kids so that they can have a skill set that would allow them to be hired in our community, it's craziness. How could you not fund these asks? And in fact, when you look at the list of asks, it's almost heartbreaking to see the work that, people did to put these incredible partnerships together and then not be funded. We were able to bump that out to two or three more because some additional dollars came out of the next session. And so that was really great, but there are still some great partnerships that were not funded, and that's part of the reason for an increased ask in this biennia. The individual people who would actually participate, I have no idea what that would look like. Nutrition programs. Slide 247. I'm making good progress. I just don't know if I'm going to get you there, but we'll get close. Oregon has the 15th highest food insecurity in the nation. And the child nutrition programs provide a healthy diet for many children. And for many children, it is their only healthy meal of the day. Yep. And it's part of what brings them to school. The number of meals served consistently has risen, and the projected number of meals served in 2014 is roughly 88.8 million meals, nearly a 6% increase over 2001's 83 million meals. Pretty incredible. 96.26% of the funds for child nutrition programs come from the federal government, while 3% are state funds and 0.74% are other funds. For the 13-15 budget, I think I already said $354 million in reimbursement. It's the largest sum of funding that Oregon receives from the federal government. It is not tied up in the ESEA that I talked about earlier. The per meal reimbursement rates for free and reduced is $2.98 per meal, and rates are set by the federal government each July 1st. Our state budget does include $3.2 million for state-sponsored programs, such as after-school meal and snack programs, breakfast and summer food programs, and farm-to-school or garden programs, which are some really incredible programs, too.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Rob, just a clarifying question. Because way back a few years ago, I was told that homeless students were eligible for some of these programs, although, I mean, after the age of, up to the age of 21. And I don't know whether that's accurate or whether, like I say, it came under the Homeless School Act through the Ag Department.
Co-Chair, I do not know the answer to that question, but I know I can bring it to you tomorrow, or I see the head of our program here in the room, if you'd like that answer.
Well, it's not urgent. It's just that it's one of those things I think we might serve our population to get that information out if it is accurate.
Oh, thank you.
And there are at least two new bills that I know of that affect nutrition. One is called After the Bell, and the other one is a program that would allow a free food for those that are eligible for reduced. So both of those bills you'll be seeing hopefully this year.
Co-Chairman Rowe, yes, and those bills are out right now and then and are important. I know that the communication, in my old district, we began to offer more robust summer feeding programs so that we had food available in a couple different sites across the district for during the summer. And getting the word out on that, you would think that, you know, it would be really easy, and it was a bigger challenge than we thought. Although, once that was established, we began to have really great access and felt like we were making a difference for kids over the summer as well. And when they show up, there's other opportunities, right? So we can make sure that books are being passed out and the like. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to now move into grant programs for teachers and other school district personnel.
Mr. Chair, there's roughly 5 minutes to the witching hour. We aren't going to finish, as even though I hoped. I don't know if this is a good break point or not, or do you want to continue for 5 minutes?
Give yourself a break.
Co-Chairs Coffin Rowe, Mr. Wilson, this would be great. You're probably tired of hearing me drone on. I do hope that I can finish tomorrow, simply because I'm in Washington, D.C. the following Monday for a couple of days of wrangling with the U.S. Department of Ed.
That shouldn't be a problem, should it?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Wilson.
Members, I need to talk to HEC because you do have quite a bit left, and there's a few other things that the committee would like to do around this. Mainly, need to go through what's included or not in the 60 million or the base or whatever we call it. So I'll talk to HEC right after the meeting. We need to make sure that we carry forward these two bills just in case, or to make sure we can do them tomorrow if that's the option.
Okay.
So
we will carry forward 5016 and 5017 and hopefully finish the work with Deputy Superintendent tomorrow, Thursday, and then we'll be getting for about 2 weeks into HEC. 3 weeks. Okay.
It's a great joke there.
Thank you very much, Mr. Saxon.
I don't know what the heck you're talking about, but
anything additional from members? Okay, thank you very much. We'll adjourn.
Thank you.